Welcome to Trauma from the Frontline. My name is Bruce Perham. I'm a counsellor who has provided counselling and training to correction officers and frontline responders for over 15 years. In this series, I will be interviewing a wide range of psychologists who work in the trauma field, key stakeholders in the emergency sector, and frontline workers who have experienced mental health and at times trauma reactions due to the field in which they work.
Hi, this is Bruce Perham. Welcome to Trauma from the Frontline. Today, my guest is Linda Caron, who is a clinical psychologist and public health trained. Linda has worked extensively in the trauma field in direct counselling, training and academic teaching. Linda is also a certified Gestalt therapist, hypnotherapist and level 2 EMDR practitioner. I could have kept going because Linda's done all sorts of different things, but I didn't want to embarrass her. Welcome to the podcast, Linda. I'm so pleased that you agreed to do it. When I went to Google and had a look at what sort of practitioner specialised in EMDR and trauma work, and your name came up several times, so I couldn't believe it when you agreed to come and talk to me. Maybe, Linda, if we could just start with, you know, your early work, where, you know, how you got into the trauma field and a little bit about your thoughts and those experiences as you developed your trauma work.
Well, I think that most clinicians, I'm a wounded healer. So I was a client before I was a therapist, right? I was a respiratory therapist, actually. I went out of high school, I became a respiratory therapist. So I had an idea that breathing might be a good thing for trauma. I had a pretty good idea about that. But I got a degree in psychology, and I got a degree in public health, like a master's degrees at those levels. And I wanted to be able to create programs and that kind of stuff. But we had I went to Gestalt training after I got my degree, and Gestalt training was the absolute best thing. And I know it's across the country, it's across the world, so you can come too, Bruce. You can become a Gestalt therapist too. But I know there's folks in Australia, but there's folks everywhere. And Gestalt therapy is the quintessential trauma therapy. It really is, because if you think about what trauma is, it is all about unfinished business. And if you're familiar with Dan Siegel does the brain in the palm of your hand, and he talks about this being sitting this way in your head, this being the front, you know, your eyes are right behind here. And he talks about this being the reptilian part of the brain, this being the mammalian or the emotional part of the brain, and this being the thinking part of the brain. And in trauma, what happens is this reptilian part of the brain that's responsible for arousal levels, sleep-wake cycles, all the things that are automatic. There's unfinished business there, because the physiological arousal that was built up, you know, to fight or to flee, was not in trauma. We were unable to discharge it. So you have unfinished physiological business. And because it was overwhelming, you're unable to feel those feelings, right? So there's either terror, rage, shame, whatever, unable to feel that. So it's unfinished emotional business, and it's unfinished cognitive business. And we have, that means, you know, the thoughts are still the same. So if I have a memory, if I have a memory of a car accident and I see glass coming and light coming towards me, the thought is I'm going to die. But if I'm sitting here with you and that memory network's not activated, I absolutely know I didn't die. But when that memory network gets activated, it feels that way, right? So when you have unfinished physiological business, unfinished emotional and unfinished cognitive business, you can't change behavior. So you have unfinished behavioral business as well. And Gestalt therapy is, that's its whole thing, right? We work with unfinished business. It is body-based, present, you know, present-centered. It's a dialogic, the I-thou relationship. So there's no real hierarchy where you have a sick doctor and you have a sick patient and a well doctor. There's nothing like that. We do mostly what we can to, even the power differential as much as you can without ever being more vulnerable than your client, of course, right? But it's body-based, here-and-now therapy with I-thou relationship. And Fritz Perls was real big on awareness, and people call it mindfulness today, but it was all about, you know, being able to focus in the present on purpose, you know, without judgment. So I think it's the perfect, I mean, it's the perfect trauma treatment. And when I was going for the training, what made it safe for me to do any of my work was that all of the trainers and all of the trainers and most of the people that were in my class were all willing to do their own work too. It wasn't like, you know, somebody, you know, we're just working with you. It's, we're all humans and we all got our shit, you know? So whatever it is, are you willing to bring it up and work with it within the group? And that was really probably the most helpful thing for me. And then the woman who was one of the directors of the Gestalt Institute, she was a trauma specialist. And she said, Linda, you work in community mental health. You see all trauma all the time. You need to get trained in EMDR. Well, Linda had to eat crow for a long time, because when I was in grad school, I had a friend who was doing her dissertation on EMDR, and I thought it was complete and utter nonsense. And she said, Linda, roll your eyes one more time. We're not going to be friends anymore. And I don't think I did roll my eyes one more time, but I remember owing her a big apology after I went for the first training, because I was sitting there with a group of strangers. You know, there was three of us and a facilitator. And, you know, I had my eyes closed, but I had, you know, tears rolling down my eyes. And that was not something that ever happened before. And so, like, when I was doing, like, that was something I was like, oh, this is different. This is, you know, this is not that talk. It's not talk therapy. There's something else happening here. And so I kind of decided to find out what it was that was happening. And like EMDRIA, who is the International Association, it's a voluntary group, but you had to go for a level one training and then a level two training. And I thought they did it backwards, because what they did in a level one training was taught you how to work with single incident trauma, which if you work in a prison or if you work in community mental health or if you work in a rehab, you're not going to see single incident trauma. You know, you don't see like somebody who was completely well and they had this one accident in their adult life, you know, and they come to you, because that's not really a good business model, right? Usually what happens is we have people in our offices that have developmental or complex PTSD, and we're just not calling it trauma. You know, it was not recognized as, you know, like legitimate, that's a legitimate disorder. And like in 1980, PTSD was encoded into RDSM, which is, the Diagnosis and Statistical Manual for Psychological Disorders. And so it was put in 1980, and it really was the first disorder that said you had to have a history of an event. Something had to happen, you know? And that was really, I think it was eye-opening in, you know, it's not what's wrong with you, it's what happened to you. And, you know, you can't, it can't unhappen, but you can process it and you can make sense of it. And it's not going to be a good story, but it's not going to be something you feel every day. It's not going to be something that, you know, keeps playing, you know, it's experienced as a trauma. And then it plays itself out in the body every day when that memory network gets activated, you know. So sometimes people just, they really don't have any idea that it's connected to a trauma. So they just think they're angry or they have panic attacks, when really, you know, it's either, if it wasn't developmental trauma or years to months in adulthood of trauma, you know, a single incident trauma can cause symptoms and really can, you know, cause a person's life to get very small. But the treatment for single incident trauma is simple. It is very easy. Almost every single one of the modalities we have will work for single incident. And again, if that's all you have, you know, if we just saw people with single incident trauma, that'd be fine. It just doesn't work that way. You know, the people that we're seeing, we have to do a lot of work in safety and stabilization before we're able to, you know, activate a trauma network, because what we're doing is deliberately destabilizing the person, right? We're activating a trauma network, which brings on the stress response. So if you don't have a person that can be regulated by you or can regulate his or her own self, you're destabilizing somebody that can't bring themselves back into their window of tolerance. You've really either re-traumatized somebody, you know, you've made it worse. You didn't help in that matter, you know? So I decided that I would teach EMDR, and I would teach it in a different way. I would teach that first you had to understand trauma. You had to understand why you were doing EMDR. I just thought that made the most sense. And then, like I said, like EMDRIA taught it, you learned single incident trauma, and then you saw, you had to do 50 sessions with people who had single incident trauma. And then with no fewer than 25 clients. And like I said, you're not going to find that in most of the venues where, you know, the psychologists or therapists work. So you would do it, you could do it with friends or whatever. And then you went back and you learned how to work with people with more acuity, like more dissociation, more complex trauma. And then you did 20 hours of consultation, then you did something usually on your with your population, or you did some other CEs on getting people ready to do EMDR, which was like a safety and stabilization. So I teach it exactly the opposite. I teach what is trauma, and then I teach how do you get people to the point where they're ready, willing, and able to benefit from this modality, because it's a very powerful modality both ways. If you use it wrong, you've re-traumatized somebody, and if you use it right, people's trauma is clear, and they move on. That it becomes a narrative rather than something that's playing itself out in the body. So I was very interested in that, and I was a good individual therapist, but I was a better group therapist, and I'm a better trainer than I am both of those things. And I think it's reaching wider and wider circles. So when you said it was surprising to you that I do this, I think that the more people that know about trauma, the more people that can treat trauma and are treated for trauma, the better our world gets. I mean, because hurt people, healed people, heal people. And I just think that this, you're across the world, but, it's dinner time here and breakfast time here, but it doesn't matter. We're all people.
Yes, at different times of the day. You've made some great points in there, Linda. And one of the, often when, I sit with people, and I'm not, I'll probably call myself generic rather than terribly specialised in any particular area, but often people really have no idea of what's happening to them, or, correction officers or police officers will say, I go to work, can't stop shaking, what the shit's this about? So I really connect with that idea of, well, people actually need to understand or connect what's actually happening to them, to then connect with how they might be able to be helped. At that process of talking to somebody about, them telling you a little bit about their trauma, you talking to them a bit about trauma reactions, are you then sort of in your own mind thinking, okay, how will I approach, or if I do EMDR, or how, is this person at risk of, I'm actually going to make them worse rather than it's going to be of help to them?
Well, that's just about assessment and assessment. Like if I'm going to see a new client, and basically I haven't taken many new clients on because I teach often. But I talk to a lot of therapists and a lot of clinicians that take on new people. So I say, tell them what I used to do because I thought it was helpful. And I have three screenings that I give out. And the first screening is for dissociation, right? If you're high in dissociation, it usually tells you not just that you have trauma, but your trauma was early and often. I do one on attachments, attachment strategies, how we do in intimate relationships, what strategies we use for that. And what that tells you is, usually how your relationship was with your primary caretaker, right? Because what we tend to do, those memories of how our needs were met or not met are really, they're laid down in unconscious memory. And we, by about 2.5 years old, they are these unconscious, stable patterns that play themselves out. Unless we bring them into awareness, they're going to play themselves out until we die. So these unconscious memories get activated in these close relationships. And we can do a screening for it, because it's not like a horoscope where it's like, oh, well, this could apply to me, this could apply to me. It's actually the behavior, like I do this or I don't do this. So do that screening. So we do dissociation, one for attachment. And then I do one that most people don't do, which is for sensitivity. So I don't know about you. I am not highly sensitive, meaning my nervous system is typical. So about 80% of the population has a typical nervous system. And then you have maybe 15 to 20% of people have a highly sensitive nervous system. And there's a woman by the name of Elaine Aron, and there's guy Jay Belke. There's a lot of people that have done research on this, animal research and human research, just to talk about, it's not a disorder, it's a survival strategy. And what it means is some folks, their nervous system means that they get activated more quickly than others. They stay activated longer. It takes them longer to come down. Novelty is particularly hard for them. And anything that is, too much for too long is generally overwhelming. So they when they go to sleep, when they dream, they wake up tired because they're processing so much more information than I take in, right? Like they take in, it's not that they're not trying to do it. Their nervous system takes in much more information than mine does. So they have to process much longer. So those three screenings are generally helpful to see if you have somebody that has early childhood trauma or early childhood trauma, abuse, or neglect. So that's what those first two do. Dissociation, if somebody's highly dissociative, you can't really do any sort of trauma processing because they're not in the room, right? You need somebody in the room with you with an observing self. So the observing self stays connected. Say you're my therapist, Bruce. I have to have an observing self that stays connected to you. Well, my experiencing self can go back and visit something that was too overwhelming to feel before, right? And go back and visit either an incident or several incidents that were too overwhelming for me to do before. Every time I tried to do it before, I got overwhelmed again. But now I'm like, when I do EMDR, I'm going in much more resourced and I have somebody there to sit, keep me from going in all different directions. And I have somebody to make sure that they're using their voice and all their cues of safety to keep my observing self present so I don't get overwhelmed again, right? So I can move through those, vehement emotions. I can get through the arousal. And then I have a story. I no longer have just body sensations or, sensory data, like I smell alcohol on somebody's breath or, I smell tires burning, like rubber burning. Like that's usually how trauma is stored more in our sensory memory. It's like body-based unconscious memories, where after EMDR, it's a story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. EMDR is really good at getting the body to know that it's over. It's one of the better ones that we have. And I think EMDR, versus prolonged exposure, it's just a kinder, gentler method, And basically, the only thing that you have to know is who's right for it and when. Because most people, probably say 95% of people can do EMDR, but not right this moment, right? Sometimes you have to do some skills building, whether it be they need some mindfulness training or they need to be able to tolerate some distress or, recognize their needs, put them out into the environment, those kind of, whatever it is that they need, those things have to be done before you deliberately destabilize somebody, right?
Yes.
So I forget what the question was, Bruce.
a quick question before I ask you a bit more about EMDR, but some time ago, I gave a presentation to a Senate, which is a government look at the mental health of first responders. And one of the senators said to me, but surely if we just screen everybody out that has had any type of trauma in their childhood, and then they go into, first responder work, that we will have kind of sorted the problem out. And it captures that kind of, obviously people go into this frontline, military or police or correction officers, they go into this frontline work with their own histories, but then they go into a world that generally says just bottle it up. And even today, there's still people will say to me, well, I just couldn't let the emotion out because it'd be a sign of weakness. And so there's this major force of almost compelling them to bottle it up. And then a bit like what you said, then they get to a point where if I actually start to talk about it, I'll lose control of it. And I'm interested in your thoughts. I sometimes think people I sit with are so disassociated from what they're actually doing that, to say, I just step over bodies or I just cut dead people down who've hung themselves or I just, get all these detached descriptions of what's going on. I call it disassociation, but it's a different disassociation. I mean, any comments on
it's purposeful.
When you get exposed to that trauma, yeah.
Yeah, when I was a respiratory therapist, so we just spent a lot of time in the emergency room, and we spent a lot of time with people who had coded, and so they're dead, and we're bringing them back, but their family's right outside, but we're in we're in a room where they can't hear us, and we're laughing, and we are disconnected from what's happening because if we're where the family is, we're not helping anybody, so we have to be less we have to be engaged in what we're doing, not, you know, not the relational piece of it, because, you know, it's like, that's what you're saying, all of these things that people talk to you about it as if they're reading the phone book, these horrible, horrible things. But that is really how you get shit done, right? I mean, you can't do it if you're, you know, if you're feeling with the family, you can't intubate somebody. If you're feeling with the family, you're not getting an A-line in, you know? I mean, all of those things matter, right? Because it's not post-traumatic stress disorder until you get out of it, right? Like, in the hospitals, we traumatized a lot of people, but that's because we saved their lives first, right? Survival is the prime directive. Once you survive, then you can go to therapy. That's the way we saw it. And that really is right, because there's not a way not to traumatize somebody when you're putting an endotracheal tube down their throat. You know, you can't look at it like that. You look at it as, we are trying to help this person survive. Once they survive, there's other services for them. There isn't another way to do it. Now, in ICU, there's different ways. I'm just talking about in emergency situation. Now, the fight flight is our fight flight system, right? The stress response is for survival, right? That's exactly what it's for. But once you survive, right, then you got to live again, right? So when you think about people who are first responders or people who were combat vets, they were in a situation where they needed to be in fight flight almost all the time, because if not, they're dead. Right. So now they come back, and now we say, you're not supposed to be in fight flight. You're not supposed to have the stress response on all the time. You're not supposed to walk into Walmart with a gun. You're not supposed to sit in the back of the room all the time and feel scared, you know, because you're supposed to be able to do relationships. Well, you can't do both. You can't be in survival mode and be in your social engagement system and be able to have meaningful emotional, meaningful relationships with folks who you love. You just can't do it, right? So what we do so very poorly as a society is, when people come back from these situations, is we do not reset their nervous systems, which is our job, by the way. I mean, not psychology. It's our job as the people who benefit from, you know, these men and women going and fighting our war. Right, I mean, that is really our responsibility, and I don't know that it's not that people don't take it seriously. I just don't think they understand it, right? So, Peter Levine, he had developed somatic experiencing. He talked to this guy called Ray, and Ray was back home, and Ray had a lot of symptoms after he was in Iraq, and he was. His Jeep was blown up. There was a whole lot of stuff that happened to him. And he had a tick, and he had PTSD, and he had a lot of stuff. And what happened was, you know, Peter said to him, you know, you have like two, let's say, hero's journeys, right? You had two hero's journeys. One is, you have to stay alive. You have to be a warrior. You know, you're keeping your buddies alive, and they're keeping you alive. And you know, you get through that hero's journey and you come home, and now everything is about relating to other people. And the only way you can relate to other people is if you are not in fight flight. So we have things to get people out of fight flight, right? Fight flight freeze, you know, or people who, you know, if you had trauma early and often, dissociation and kind of a collapse or a dorsal vagal response is more what you see. People who, you know, they just... you know, their heart rates go down, their blood pressure goes down. There's the energy is not there. With people who are in fight flight, you know, where there's a lot of hyper arousal, there's a lot of hypervigilance, there's all that stuff. But people who have had trauma early and often, you don't see that much. What you see is, you know, there's about 14% of people that have PTSD that as soon as their heart rate starts to go up, it decelerates immediately. Their muscles go flaccid. You know, they don't necessarily pass out, but their blood pressure drops out, their heart rate goes down, like all of the opposite of what you see in PTSD, you know? So the idea is, how do you get people to understand what their symptoms are? Now, again, I have the benefit of having worked with first responders a lot of my career. I did that. And I trained a lot of people, I would say a lot of people, but I used to live in Pennsylvania, and I trained all of the state troopers there to work with, you know, the people that were in the EAP, you know, the employee, they talked to their guys. Yes. So I did EMDR. I'm sorry. Did you say something, Bruce? I didn't hear you.
No, I was listening. Yep, keep going.
Okay. Yeah, that showed up. So I worked, but just talking about that, the working with first responders and the state police. And so I trained the state police to do EMDR because EMDR is a beautiful modality because you don't have to talk about it, right? So you have a lot of people that have had, you know, they may very well have been in combat or they may very well be first responders, but they all might also may have been raped in childhood. They may have had abuse in childhood and they're never going to talk about that. So they won't come to therapy for it. Where EMDR is, you do not have to talk about it for it to work. You have to be able to be with it, you know? And if I was your therapist, I'd say, bring up the image that represents the worst of it and tell me when you have it. I'm not going to ask you what it is. You just have to tell me that you have it. And then I ask for emotions, body sensations, you know, thought, and then we start processing. But I think if you want to know anything about EMDR for first responders, that's the best thing you can tell them, is because, you know, people think of emotions and you said feelings as weakness. It couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, all emotions are, or well, first off, they're evolutionary life-saving, right? That's one thing. But the other thing is they're information. You're not supposed to act on every emotion you have. I mean, I can get pissed off real quick. I'm not going to go throw punches at folks, right? It's more of what is the information telling me, right? Is it something from, is it from the past? Do I have to deal with something from the past? Or is it in the present? Or is something in the present triggering me? And now I have this great big reaction that is inappropriate for the current situation. And those are the things you tease out, right? Like, oh yeah, well, I wanted to punch this guy in his neck and all he did was, you know, he let somebody in front of him, you know, or whatever. It's like, okay, so this is a big reaction. I'm not saying act on that emotion. Pay attention to what is it coming up around? Is it really for now or is it something, you know, or is it from, you know, earlier stuff that hasn't been looked at or hasn't been processed yet? First responders are one of my favorite folks. I mean, we talk about first responders being EMTs or paramedics or police officers, you know, but like all of the people that have to do these really difficult things, whether we're talking about combat or whether we're talking about, you know, responding to these things, like you said, somebody hung themselves and I have to go in and cut them down, or I have to clean, you know, somebody, you know, slice their throat and I have to clean this up. And just see how horrible humans can be to one another. There's also another side of it, right? When you see just that, that's what you think the world is, you know, and that isn't what the world is. That's some of what the world is, you know? I mean, everybody isn't shitty. Everybody isn't a criminal. Everybody, you know, everybody doesn't do horrible things to one another. But when you're in that world, like if you're in the police world, whatever, and you see it all the time, you kind of start to generalize. And I'd like to say that's one thing that people ought to not do, which is if they are, you know, if they work in the hospital or if they work, you know, on the police force, don't go watch those movies, you know, watch things that are more about attachment or watch things that are more about relations. And even if it feels like this, I'm sorry, even if it feels like, this is so corny or this is whatever, those are the things we need to be exposing ourselves to, you know, paying attention to what's ours, but also not falling into, oh yeah, well, the world sucks. Everything.
They're all such major issues, Linda, that so many people over the years talk about that, not being able to come down, they're perpetually hypervigilant, you know, that they walk off the job, they can't turn the hypervigilance off. And so they drink. It becomes a permanent state. And the number of officers, correction and police, that have said to me, you know, I'm so different to how I used to be. And my family tell me that. And, you know, as you said, I drink more. Maybe it's a good opportunity to really connect with the idea of we actually need to be doing this while people are in these environments, because they are every day. And there's a dearth of any ideas here, really, of how do we actually work with first responders to prolong their careers and minimise the psychological damage that the work is doing to them. So it's a really good point to come in about, well, when you do the EMDR with the troopers or the police or people, what does that do for them in the moment to help them keep doing the work?
Well, I would say first, before EMDR is, it's say you have, but there's plenty of people that have things that are unprocessed in their past. But when we talk about people that have trauma early and often, you really have to address that and teach people what they didn't get. Meaning, if they didn't learn how to tolerate distress, or if they didn't learn how to regulate themselves because they didn't have a mother or a father that was able to regulate their own selves. If your mother can't regulate herself, she certainly can't regulate you. And it's the same thing with therapists, right? It's the same thing with teachers. If they can't regulate themselves, they can't regulate the folks they're supposed to be regulating. So the very first thing that anybody that's in my job has to do is become an expert at their own physiology and how to calm themselves down, right? Because I mean, it's easy for us to resonate with one another. We have mirror neurons all over. That's what we do, right? But if I can keep my body calm, I'm not resonating with high anxiety, right? It's not that I'm like saying, like pretending it doesn't exist. I can feel it, right? If you're really upset or somebody's sitting in the office with me, say, what do you notice? And we drop people into their bodies, have them put their hand over their heart, their hand on their cheeks. We have a lot of different ways to calm people's physiology. In the moment, there's a lot of, like, I'll send them to you because I have tons of them, right? I mean, I wrote a whole 101 trauma-informed interventions just for people so they could do these things on their own, right? Like they can do, I mean, you obviously can't do relational therapy on your own, but some of the skills training you can. If you want to know what I think is the best idea for first responders and for military people, it's something that's been used for millennia, and it's been used in the Native American cultures or the indigenous folks here. It's called a sweat lodge. And a sweat lodge is, I mean, you may have heard it in bad terms, but a sweat lodge is a Native American purification ceremony. And they build a sweat lodge, which is, I would say probably big enough for about 15 people in it and tight, packed tight. But where it came from is, braves and the Native American braves would go out and they would fight against the white folk who were trying to kill them. So they would fight and they would come back. But the braves were not allowed to come back to society. They could not come back to their tribe until they went to the sweat lodge. The sweat lodge was however long it took for every single person, right, that was with them, however long it took for them to be regulated and be ready to go, that's when they all went back. So you have this group that goes into this sweat lodge, which is it's sensory deprivation and sensory overload at the same time. It's extreme heat. They keep bringing in rocks, real hot rocks. They bring them in, and then they say a prayer in the east, prayer in the south, a prayer in the north, and a prayer in the a prayer in the west, and a prayer in the north. And they do chanting, they do drumming, they do singing. They, can if people need prayers for certain things, they ask for that. And prayers really are just you're calling for somebody to feel you, right? It's like rather than calling on God, we're calling on whatever higher power, whatever to say, this I this this is. This isn't this. I'm not okay. I need help, right? Basically, you're saying that you're calling out, and then they, there's like I said, the singing, there's chanting, there's drumming, and all of these things bring on the parasympathetic nervous system. That's their job, right? The vagus nerve is it's the longest nerve we have. It's the 10th cranial nerve. Anytime you activate the vagus nerve, you activate the parasympathetic nervous system. Anybody who is hypervigilant, anybody who is hyper aroused, anybody who is on guard all the time, all of these things would work, right? Any of the things that bring that activate the vagus nerve bring the sympathetic arousal down. So, whether you're doing, one of these things where you're doing a neurovascular hold, where you're breathing in through your nose, you bring your chin up, bring your chin down to your chest as you exhale through pursed lips. You do like a round of those. There's a lot of tapping points. We have these meridian points that are higher energy points. There's a lot of things, a lot of points that you could hold. There's points for dissociation. There's points for just really just for future worry, those kind of things. I just think that I think that there's so much wisdom that we've said, oh no, that's not for us. We want to think about it, right? We want to just have this part of us is just a transport object to bring this really important thing around. it just doesn't work that way. We are an integrated species. We're a servo. We are a servo system. Anything that happens in my gut registers up here. Anything that registers up here registers in my gut. There is, you know, I think PTSD was really the first disorder to say, you know, Rene Descartes, you were wrong. There is no mind-body split. There isn't. It just doesn't make sense to even treat an to treat a human that way, because we are an integrated species. So that's where I am with that.
Well, gee, Linda, that is so interesting because, you know, I was thinking a lot of things. That one in the training, generally the first responder promotion will be come in, make a difference, change people's lives, you know, go home feeling you achieve something. And there's very little, I don't know that there's anything in the training that will connect with the body. You know, it's just not discussed. It's not even mentioned that you're going into a profession that is going to do all sorts of things to your mind and your body. And officers tell you that. And yet there's absolutely nothing that addresses that or prepares people. Just when you were talking, I thought it's just so obvious that we need to be teaching people that this is going to impact on your mind and it is going to impact on your body, and to have some strategies around what you need to do at those times. I love the Native American Indian of just that deregulating yourself, you know, bringing yourself down. And officers try and do that on their own. They try and on the drive home or drinking too much or you know, often are naturally really trying to do that, but don't really have a sense of how to or why. So really connect with that. What's your experience of getting organisations who employ, you know, these workers to start to understand the complexity of the psychology of it?
Well, I think that's the part that it's even in the question. It isn't the psychology, it's the physiology, right? And I think that's how we reach first responders, is because they had to learn the body, right? We all had to learn the sympathetic nervous system, you know, when we like, so they have an idea of it. So I think that's the way in, right? Is to teach people to say, okay, well, you're in a sympathetic nervous response. That's what you're in, an arousal response. So what's the answer to that? Well, you can stay in that, right? But besides the fact that it's unpleasant because you get, you know, triggered very quickly, you get angry very quickly, you know, when you're hyper aroused and all that, it's also causes disease. I mean, that just to bring it out there, I mean, all of these things are what cause inflammation. Right? And inflammation is really what's under almost every one of the diseases. Now, you have people that are doing the best they can. Please don't hear it any other way. People are doing the best they can and they're doing what they know. And I think that it is our responsibility to teach people that, you know what, I know you're doing the best you can. And I know that, you know, you try to have a couple drinks before you go home. So you're not, you know, angry with your kids or, you know, you're not flip. Does that work? And the answer is usually no, right? The answer is no, it doesn't work. You know, either I drink too much or I stay out, you know, like I start to drink and I don't come home and I don't think, you know, I don't feel safe. Like I don't feel like I'm a safe person around my children because I just had 6 drinks and I thought I was just going to have 2. One of the things I like, and I don't know where you are, but up in New England, people get off the train and sit on the beach for 10 minutes. Like the train stops there at the beach and then they go home. That's one of the things I think, you know, connecting with nature, connecting with, I like the idea of pubs, but most of, like, I'm an alcoholic, so pubs don't work. Like when I quit drinking, pubs were not the things I wanted to do. I mean, that was, you know, I was 24 when I quit drinking, but you know, it's the idea is social. The idea is, you know, to be in your social engagement system, but you also have to, you know, you also have to drink alcohol, right? You know, I mean, I'm not saying you have to, but most people do when they go to a pub. And I think that's more of a mistake because, you know, you're anesthetizing yourself again rather than, okay, I have, you know, like I had a really hard day, rather than processing the day, you medicate, you know, and the medication only works until it stops working.
Yes. So tell me a bit about EMDR. You know, what's people often will say to me, or the psychologist suggested that they have EMDR, and I've never really had the opportunity to really get an understanding of it. What does it do? How does it help?
Well, I'll tell you how it helps. I'll tell you that there's another thing. Everybody has a lot of theories about how it works, but it's still out there. You know, there's nobody has a, you know, like said, oh, this is exactly what happens. But the theory that makes sense to me is really we have something called an orienting response. So like if I do that and you're here, you hear a noise, you orient towards that noise, right? Because we have a part of our brain here called the hippocampus that if there's anything novel, it has to pay attention. You know, I'm going to give you an idea. So like if you have a projector on or a fan on, and you're in that room, you do not continuously pay attention to the fan, right? You tag it, okay, it's the fan. If you kept paying attention to it, that's usually what happens with people who are on the spectrum. They can't block out irrelevant stimuli, right? But most people, they say, okay, well, that's what that is. It's a fan. I don't need to pay attention. The only other time you'll pay attention is when that fan goes off, right? You orient towards the novel. And I think the orienting response in EMDR is really the best way to explain it, because what happens is, let's say this is a neural network. A neural network means neurons have fired together, now wire together, right? So a neuron's just a brain cell. I mean, it's just a brain cell, right? But when you have neurons that fire together, right, it says they wire together, they create neural networks. And these neural networks, once they, you know, get laid down together and they get reinforced a few times, they're likely the whole neural network comes up, not just like the sensory data or not just the emotions. So when you have something that is considered traumatic, let's just say it's at one event, you have an image or a lot of images, because image is just not a picture. Images are all the sensory data. So what do you smell? What do you see? What do you hear? What do you feel on your skin? So all the sensory data, and that's part of the neural network. And then you have emotions that are part of the neural network. And then you have the stress response that's part of the neural network. And sometimes you have a thought that's part of the neural network too, right? So let's call this our trauma neural network. Now, what's different about a trauma neural network is every time this comes up, it comes up exactly the same way. And when this neural network gets lit up, this part, the thinking part of the brain, goes offline, right? Because the stress response sends it offline. The hippocampus tags it. And then the other part of the brain in the emotional part is the amygdala, right? The amygdala said, this is, you know, the smoke detector. So the smoke detector is going off. The hippocampus tags it, and then this part goes offline. The memory does not get laid down in long-term memory. It stays exactly the way it is, the way it happened the first time. That neural network gets lit up. Every time it gets lit up, this part goes offline, and it doesn't get processed. When you go to sleep at night, you know, we go into REM sleep. And as soon as you start to process that memory network, whether it's metaphorically or whether, you know, it feels real or it's a metaphor, this part goes offline and you woke up like this. You know, you wake up in a heightened arousal state, right? So it doesn't get processed. Now with EMDR, what happens is we deliberately activate that neural network. We do. We say, bring up the image that represents the worst of it. What emotions come up? Where do you feel it in your body? And is there a thought? And once that's up, then something else happens. And the something else happened is called a dual awareness stimulus. So whether you hear beep, 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 or you're holding something in your hands and it's buzz, 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 or you're watching a light, you know, you're crossing the midline. So neurons in the visual cortex, like if I look over there, neurons in my visual cortex light up. If I look over there, neurons here light up. Now, if I'm holding them in my hands, which is usually what I do. So if it's buzzing in this hand, neurons in the somatosensory cortex that never fired are now firing, right? What does that mean? Well, that means the hippocampus has to come back online. And the hippocampus is the general, but the hippocampus's job is to put things in context. this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then it was over. See, the hippocampus hasn't been a part of this, right? Because every time that neural network came up before, this went offline. Now I go, here's your neural networks lit up, but now this is buzzing. I turn my TheraTapper on, or I turn on that dual stool awareness stimulus, it buzzes here, neurons fire here. The hippocampus goes, what's this? It's novel. Is it a threat? No. Is it interesting? No. Back to the memory. But then it buzzes over here, neurons over here that never fired before. Same thing. Hippocampus has to say, what's this? It's novel. Is it a threat? No. Back to the memory. And so on and so on. So what you're doing is you're keeping the person's arousal levels down a little bit, and you're keeping the hippocampus online. So what happens is people move through, you know, say you start at, like, we go 0, no distress, 10, the worst. Say you start at a 9. Start coming down, the arousal levels come down. And that emotion was terror. But now you have rage, and now you're up to 10. So now you bring that back down, right? And now maybe it's shame, and it comes back up again, and it goes back down. Then you get your arousal level, you know, you process everything that's related to that memory, and you bring the arousal level down to 0. And you say, now keep that image up, the one we started with, and what do you believe about yourself now? So let's just go back to my old one. I said, okay, I'm going to die, right? Because that was the one I was telling you with, I see the light coming towards me, right? So I said, keep that image up. What's the thought now? Well, I did the best I could. So then, you know, so you kind of repair that, right? That new thought with this, the worst of it, right? And then you do a body scan to make sure that if there's any, you know, any remnants of the stress response still there, you keep that image up and you do, you know, you run a body scan, you get people up, shake it off a little bit. And that's basically what you do for EMDR. Now, EMDR is easy. It is the easiest thing I could ever teach anybody. The only problem is when it goes badly. Right. So you have to know what, you know, you have to know why you're using it. You have to know what to do when it doesn't go well, and what to do when you've assessed, you and your client decided that, yes, the client has the skills to stay stable. It's a good time to do it, blah, blah, blah. And then it goes poorly. Say the person dissociates, or you have to get the person back in the room, you know, say you just start doing EMDR and you do a couple sessions because people have more than one trauma to process. But then, you know, the quality of life begins to, you know, go down. So what do? Well, you stop doing EMDR, right? You get people more resources. So if you think of trauma in terms of, we had like a triphasic model, but really the first phase is safety and stabilization and building rapport with somebody. And the second stage is processing those memories, right? They used to say that the third stage would be reintegration into larger systems. But most of us really believe that if you don't do that in the first phase, you don't really move out of the first phase. So that's the way I explain EMDR to my clients. And again, it's not a pleasant session, EMDR, but it's over after that. Like all the body sensations are gone. The person can remember it, right, as a narrative. This happened, then this happened. They don't feel it in their body anymore, and those emotions don't come up for them. It's a story now. It's a bad story. It's never going to be a good story, right? But, you know, at the end of it, it's either like, I learned it's not happening now, or I'm safe now, I did the best I could, or, some people did something wrong. If they committed a crime or they hurt somebody, that's never going to change from EMDR, but there's more of an acceptance there. So what you're asking for is like a more adaptive cognition to pair with the original image. I have not seen it go poorly.
Yeah. Has there been situations where it's been utilized in organizations as a current sort of support, you know, that you know, people, when they go into a trauma event, you know, like they do regularly, that they would then have that experience as a part of the processing of what's happened? Like, sort of not routinely,
yeah,
but whenever
it's required. Well, no, they can. As a matter of fact, it's like if you have a first responder that goes in, you can have them do, like, we also have like just EFT, which is called Emotion Freedom Technique, which is a tapping technique. And for people to bring their arousal levels down, that's really one of the best things I've seen. It's not hard. It looks weird, right? But I mean, you can teach people to do it so it doesn't look so weird. And the reason I'm saying that is because some people go on public transportation and they have, like these hyperarousal symptoms. But you can teach them how to do it where you do a touch and breathe method so people don't really know that they're, tapping and stuff like that. EMDR isn't really it's not done routinely as like let's process this stressful event because trauma and stress are not the same thing. People use the words interchangeably, but they're not interchangeably. By its definition, anything that is traumatic was stressful, but anything that's stressful is by no means traumatic. What it means to be traumatized is that there was an event or an event that that overwhelmed my ability to cope, right? So it was overwhelmed my capacity, whether that was internal resources or external resources, it was overwhelmed. And my nervous system has now shifted states. That's what trauma means. It doesn't matter what happened, right? If that happened, you've been traumatized. But there's plenty of stressful events that, I mean, we're built for them. We have a stress response, and what's supposed to happen is, you get the energy you need to fight or to flee, and within seconds, we're talking this is only like seconds to minutes is what our defenses are supposed to be, right? So, but people keep their stress response on for whole careers, for lifetimes, and that's not what they're built for. These were built for short-term defensive actions, So, I think again, I want to say to talk about first responders, you want to talk about that because you're talking about something they already know about. They know about the body. They know about the autonomic nervous system somewhat. I mean, if you're a paramedic, you absolutely know these things, right? If you're a cop, you know some of it. If you're I'm thinking, combat vet, if you're a corpsman or whatever, you know it. So, I mean, I think that's the way to approach it because most people, I think this is not being I don't think people are ignorant in any way. It's just they don't have any They don't have, there's no impetus to learn about trauma unless you've been truly traumatized, and then you have to seek help. But people like to say, well, she had it worse than me, or that's, I wasn't in the Holocaust, or I wasn't in combat. That isn't what trauma means. Trauma means it doesn't matter what the event was. If you were overwhelmed and your nervous system shifts states, it doesn't matter what happened to you. Nobody, it don't, doesn't matter if the, it's like saying I can't go to the emergency room with this broken femur because somebody else had a heart attack or a stroke. It's not relative. Trauma is not relative. I mean, if you can clear trauma, and trauma can happen from just about anything because it's not about the event. It's a person's perception of their own safety in the event. It doesn't have to be real. It's their perception because to the nervous system, perception is reality, right?
So in lots of ways, I really connect with, we all need to tune into ourselves in terms of I'm actually experiencing a trauma reaction, or I'm reacting in a way that I was overwhelmed. Because I think that gets crushed very quickly after a trauma event where people, I'm fine. Yep, no, I'm good. Yep, no issue. Don't need counseling. Don't need anything. Good to go. Good to get up the next day, and don't stop enough to connect with. Well, in actual fact, I was really quite distressed about that. So in a way, it is that kind of, if you experience it, you are actually overwhelmed by a situation, whatever it is. As a early preventative, that could then be the time, okay, I need to seek some help with this. Is that where you think that's where we need to
Well,
be
you
moving
could,
to?
sure. Well, I would, before going to say you need to treat somebody for a trauma, I would say that people need to learn about their own physiology and how to regulate themselves, because that's really like regulating yourself means that if I've been traumatized, it's real hard for me to regulate myself. But if I haven't been, if I've just been through a lot of, stressful incidents, and you know, I'm a little shaky, whatever. If I learn how to, you know, like do box breathing, right, or do 4-7-8 breathing, if I learn how to bring my body and mind back into my window of tolerance, right, I can keep doing that, right? I mean, and it takes a while. You have to, you know, you have to do it a lot of times for it to become second nature, right? Now, people that are become first responders or people that go into, you know, into the military service, a lot of them already have nervous systems that are set on hyperarousal. And I can tell you this for my own experience. I went into respiratory therapist and worked in the emergency room exclusively there and the NICU because I live at a real high level of arousal, or I lived right at a high level of arousal, and I could still function because I grew up in chaos, right? So I found a situation or a career that fit my nervous system. Well, I have a new career and I don't need that level of hyperarousal, right? So I had to learn how to regulate myself so that when I'm not in danger, my body's not telling me I'm in danger. You know, when I'm sitting in a room talking to you, even though you're across the globe, I'm not in any danger, you know, and, you know, some people, like, you know, you go into a stress response because you're taking a test, or you go into a stress response because you get a letter from the board, or you get a letter from an auditor, you know, that's not what our stress response were built for. They were built for run away from saber-toothed tigers. It's a different situation. You know, we have to learn how that, when are we really in danger? Because when you're in danger, you certainly don't want to feel safe. You know, you want to stay alive, right? But if you're not in danger, you want to be able to bring your body to know that you're not in danger. So you stop producing all that adrenaline. So you stop producing cortisol, because that's where disease comes from. And again, that's why I think it wouldn't be that difficult to teach, you know, folks that are in the medical world or folks that are, you know, first responders, because they already know that, right? I mean, they had to learn a disease model.
Yeah, well, there's so much food for thought, because it's been very helpful for me, Linda, because there's so many issues that I see, but I'm kind of more of a talking person. But I really identify there's so much more that needs to be available to people too, like just that, how do you deregulate yourself quickly? Because you've got 12 hours before you're back there, so you don't, you know, you have to kind of do that pretty quickly. Which is, you know, I think people jump into the alcohol because it's quick. But to be learning those other things that they need to be doing to, that, you know, it's normal to come off your shift to be hyper-regulated, but you need to be doing a whole range of different things to bring that down. And as a comment here, there's, and particularly with our police and the military, there's a lot more awareness about, you know, 40% of police leave the force with PTSD. And so there's increased awareness about we need to support those officers, and we need to give them a lot more access to mental health support. But I think, you know, we're all kind of really ultimately floundering at, well, how do we minimize that as their careers go on? And, you know, some of what you've talked about is just so core to that of just getting back. I will now be talking complex physiology. I'll change my language from psychology, because I really connect with that. And that we need to be broadening that in educating people. Any sort of final comments? I've loved talking to you. It's been so eye-opening for me. Any other sort of final comments before we close?
Well, I but again, I would say it's incumbent upon us to find things that work for all of these populations, because they're in service of us, you know, and it is, it isn't their problem. It's society problem, right? I mean, the only thing I could say about, with people who go into combat, or people that, you know, the 40% that you say leave with PTSD, there's a percentage that went in with it, and they went in with developmental trauma, and they're the ones that really need to see someone like me, or someone, you know, who understands developmental trauma, right? Because what happens with developmental trauma, if you grow up in, you know, that's a war-torn place, or gang violence, or domestic abuse, domestic violence. If you grew up like that, your brain and yourself is built around that. So some people, only feel alive when they're threatened, only feel alive when they're facing death. And that's because their self was, you know, their self was developed around that, you know, and that's something that there's a specialty to that, right? There's a specialty to know that. And I don't think everybody can do it, but everybody can do the rest of the stuff that I was talking about. I mean, EMDR is easy. You just have to know when to use it, right? These teaching skills, you know, a lot of people who have what we call borderline personality disorder, which is the worst word in the world, right? What it means is they have a high sensitivity and they were met with an invalidating environment, right? But these people, it's when I say these people, well, people that have those two things in common, that prognosis is better than most prognoses. And, you know, the people in mental health really have this, we've been taught that this is a real vehement disorder and you don't want these folks around. That's my favorite population because these folks get better, right? When they understand that they have a highly sensitive nervous system and they understand they make some compensatory, they do things to compensate for the fact that they do take in more information than others and they do need to regulate themselves and they do, you know, they miss some of those skills because, you know, instead of, you know, mother mirroring the child, they said, you know, basically like, oh, why are you crying? I'll give you something to cry about, rather than, you know, what's supposed to happen to humans is, you know, the primary caretaker is supposed to recognize the child's in distress and say, oh, honey, you're sad or you're angry or, you know, you're happy, whatever. You're supposed to mirror the child. And if that doesn't happen, it still has to happen eventually. There needs to be correctives, you know. And in society, we think, oh, well, you know, that's a child's need. Yeah, but the childhood needs that don't get met become adult needs. I mean, period. And none of us can go it alone. This pandemic really should have brought that home to everybody. You know, we all say, oh, I wish I lived on an island by myself. Nobody does. We are herd animals. We do not do well without other people. We're herd animals, and we need to rely on one another. And I said we need to trust one another, but we also need to become trustworthy. You know, and I think my profession needs to do a better job. And I think society in general needs to do a better job of saying, look, when people are risking their life for us, we owe them something. There is a debt. You know, there's a debt that we. You know, we have to pay that back. Now, whether it means, I know it doesn't mean just wearing a yellow ribbon, or it doesn't mean wearing a, you know, like a, you know, something that says awareness. It's no, we owe it to them to figure out what's going to work. You know,
that's the core message. You know, we really have to leave no stone unturned to provide what. These workers do, who provide essential services. You know, we absolutely have to have them. And then we have to really care what happens to them. And,
oh, 100%. Yeah, and it's, but that's the thing. I mean, like, you know, I say hurt people, heal people, heal people. But it's also, if we don't support them, they're done. We're done. I mean, you know, they're in our service and we ought to be in their service.
Absolutely. It's just a loop that we all need to connect with, and people in positions of responsibility need to connect with it. Thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me. And I've totally enjoyed it. And I'm sure the people that listen to this podcast will totally enjoy it.
Thank you for joining me on this latest episode of Trauma from the Frontline. If you would like to get in touch with me, or if you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to email me at bruce@letstalkdifferently.com.au. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at Trauma from the Frontline. If you are enjoying this series, please make sure you follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts. And if you find this information valuable, we ask that you rate the show 5 stars. It really helps the show grow and reach a larger audience. Until the next episode, please take care. If this episode has raised any issues for you, free counselling is available through your organisation's employee assistance provider, Lifeline on 131 114, or Beyond Blue on 1300 224 636.